FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is a Monday, January 27th. Well, haven't heard much about Hong Kong lately. Had a lot of news coming out of China, the coronavirus. Now it's spread to the U.S. It's spreading all over the place. Panic has ensued, especially because we're right on the cusp of the Chinese New Year, and everybody wants to celebrate. Tens of millions of Chinese travel back and forth, traversing the country in an effort to get home and celebrate with loved ones. And we've seen some of the world's largest traffic jams in recorded history occur. Train systems break down, things happen due to weather. So it's going to be interesting to see what effect this has. And then we're also going to review what's happening in Hong Kong now and Taiwan, because that's kind of fallen off the radar screen. And we're really fortunate to have a good friend of the show on. We haven't talked to him lately. His name is Daniel Joseph. You find his work at ChinaLearningCurve.com. Dan, you've been a consultant, author, filmmaker. You've been involved with China for many years, lived there. And we really appreciate you coming back on the show. So the coronavirus, it looks like there's a panic going on about it, huh?
Yes. Terry, thanks for having me again. Good to be on the show. So in the last couple of days, more information has been revealed. The number of reported cases in China increased, you know, two or three times. And then we've got reported cases in, as you mentioned, the United States, not to mention, you know, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan, Thailand. So the list is growing, and along with it, the concern is growing. Initially, there was at least a report of a feeling on the part of doctors that this was not transmittable human to human. They've now put that aside and said it most definitely is. So now it's time to kind of, for China, they're having SARS flashbacks. For your listeners might remember when they had a huge outbreak more than a decade ago that they underreacted to and then tried to catch up. 800 people ended up dying, and it was a big deal. They had to close down large parts of the country for a while. So they're going to try to do more here in the short term to avoid that. But this looks like it could be a much bigger problem than even the World Health Organization was speculating 3 or 4 days ago.
Yeah, it's just incredible the way these viruses come out of like literally thin air. And I'm not of the conspiracy theory that it came from a weapons lab in some country, you know, they're trying to kill off humanity, but you know, they do periodically, you get these pandemics. It's almost 100 years. Or it's a little more than 100 years since the great pandemic of World War I, which took out millions of people. And that's always on everyone's mind, is this the next plague? And you know, when you look at it, so it's propensity of human beings to panic and overreact to these things. And it's a propensity of governments to try to downplay and underplay these things so that everyone stays calm. Somewhere in the middle is the truth. But I guess you've been talking to your friends in China. You got an idea of how they're reacting?
Oh, absolutely. The I think during the SARS epidemic, there was clearly legitimate reason to criticize the Chinese government for putting politics and public perception over, you know, good public health policy. No doubt about it. This time around, they've done a lot in the ensuing years to build a better health infrastructure to handle these types of things. That doesn't mean it's perfect, just a lot better than it was. And I would say that less that there, even if bad decisions have been made thus far, it's less because people are playing politics and more because these things are hard to predict sometimes. But now what they've done from saying, well, we think it's under control, we've contained, and there were a lot of reports that the city where it originated, Wuhan, you could barely even notice anybody was concerned. Now you can't, you know, face masks are flying off the shelves, they're mass producing them.
Yeah.
And they basically said you can't travel out of the center city, Wuhan, or a couple of surrounding cities, like you said. So they're clamping down pretty hard. And I think, and the WHO has been involved from the beginning, And the United States has researchers who are lending a hand in parts of the investigation. And so I think the response, you know, should be, let's just say, professional and well-ordered from here. But you never know what, I mean, you know, like you said, there's a lot of mystery around these things. We don't necessarily, we think we know how to contain them, but each new strain, every time it happens, is another challenge.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I guess, you know, now we've got the second reported case in the U.S. So, and it's gone to other countries in Asia. Supposedly, you know, I read something, a couple of scientists have said it doesn't appear to be anywhere near as bad as SARS. One of the big risks is that it overwhelms the health services of the affected countries. And so far, we're not seeing that. But hey, when in doubt, panic. That was a thing that I saw in the 60s. And it seems to hold true today as well. So, hey, getting on to it. So, trade war, it looks like there's an agreement. I guess the first stage is really an agreement to agree to more agreements, right? I mean, it's nothing final, but we kind of get an idea of where this is heading.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Luminex Resources, ticker symbol LR on the Toronto Venture and LUMIF on the OTC, is a member of Lumina Group, the Ross Beaty company that has returned nearly 10-1 to investors since its founding in 2004. It's currently advancing a portfolio of large-scale exploration properties in Ecuador with 3 key assets and 2 world-class partners, Anglo American and BHP. With the decline in other sectors of its economy, Ecuador is aggressively nurturing its growing mining sector, and Luminex is a prime beneficiary of the new policy. If passed as prologue, investors should see outsized returns on the company's gold and copper holdings. For more info, go to luminexresources.com and make sure you sign up to get the company's latest notifications. That's luminexresources.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Yeah, so the phase one deal is completed. It's a good first step. There's some really good things in there for the United States, no doubt about it. But there's also some big question marks how certain things are going to work. And we did leave the thornier issues, the more difficult ones, undone. They're going to have to be addressed with what presumably will be a phase two agreement. And there's some disagreement as to whether that negotiations on that second phase will begin sooner or later, maybe not even during the election year. But it's, you know, in these highly politicized times, Terry, as I'm sure you know, you've got a whole range of reactions from, you know, this is the greatest deal ever to, well, we're still worse off than we were before the trade agreement. I think there's actually some good things in there, but we'll have to wait and see how it all works out.
Of course. Of course. So it is significant, though. And in effect, the agreement was already underway before they even signed it, because they're having real agricultural issues and the hog population of China. All these things converged where they couldn't just say, oh, we'll get all those agricultural products elsewhere and forget about the U.S. And I guess, you know, Trump played the Trump card on trade pretty effectively.
If you look at the agreement, if you look at the experience, I think one of the lessons both sides see is that, there's pain to be had on both sides when you engage in these kind of things. I think the fact, you know, farmers getting hit so bad are one of the reasons that the Trump administration became very eager to do a deal, and China was suffering on the manufacturing side. And the question is, do we get the rest of this done without a return to the escalation in tariffs? Keep in mind that many of the tariffs are still in place right now. But when you look at particularly the provisions relative to intellectual property, forced technology transfer, to me, those are the headliners. If you read the wording, the commitments made by China are actually very substantial.
Meaningful.
Those are priority issues for U.S. companies, and I think those are big wins.
Hey, and, you know, the Chinese have to look at this and say, all right, intellectual property, that is the new precious metal, if you will, of the technological age, and they're becoming a technological innovator. So if they want their patents honored and their intellectual property respected, then they've got to start doing it and doing the same to others. It can't just be a one-way street.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The irony of this whole thing is that most of what we're asking China to do, and maybe all of it, is actually good for China, and they should be doing it anyway. every developing country in the world has weakness in the rule of law, which extends to intellectual property. Intellectual property protection is weak in Brazil, India, Russia, China, all of them. China has actually made some really good progress over the last 10 years, largely because of the phenomenon you're describing. They're creating more of their own innovation content that needs to be protected. But as you know, what you find with China is they make progress, but maybe they, particularly in the last 10 years, they could have done more. They should have done more. They should have driven harder. A great example would be that forced technology transfer. That was something that was outdated 10 years ago. It didn't matter 30 years ago. Now it does. So what we've really done is prodded them to move faster in this part of the journey, if you will. They were already moving a little bit, but we pushed them further. And it's good for us, but it's good for them, too, as you said.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And really, rule of law, it's really the one thing perhaps that's keeping China from becoming the dominant world power. You can comment on the U.S.'s rule of law. There's lots of flaws in it for sure. But when it comes to what China has compared to the U.S., they've got a long way to go here.
Oh, absolutely. It's the greatest challenge facing developing countries. Again, it's across the board. You know, India has had elections and a so-called democratic government for 70 years. And their ranking on the Corruption Perception Index, which is a measurement used to measure corruption in countries throughout the world, is no better than China, okay? Because elections don't really contribute much to that. What really does is free market-oriented economic development. And that's the path that China is on. Now, if China doesn't keep reforming, it's not going to keep growing. If it doesn't keep growing, then the forces that help strengthen the rule of law are not going to be applied, and they're going to not move off the point they are right now, which is, you said, right now, they still have a lot of progress to make. And if that happens, they're not going to become, you know, kind of the world power with a big, you know, global footprint that they'd like to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so essential because when the studies, and I don't remember the studies now, you might remember them better than myself, but studies on how countries grow and why they grow, why they become prosperous. Number one is rule of law. Number two is protection of private property. And then free market economics, you know, there's a whole checklist of things. And, you know, the U.S. has fallen back on a lot of these areas. China, to really become this country that they want to become, really has to start focusing on those things more so than they have in the past.
Absolutely. That's the next stage of development. The first 30 to 40 years were for them. And then, by the way, what you described is correct. Private property, free markets, it all contributes to the rule of law. And that's what it takes. And that's why there's such on these issues, a huge divergence between developing countries and those that are already more developed and advanced. And like you said, frankly, although the United States retain a large lead over a country like China in these all important issues, that doesn't mean we don't have our own weaknesses. And that doesn't mean we can't fall one or two steps behind where we were in the past. And I would agree with you that we have. But for China to avoid what's called the middle income trap and keep going. And keep in mind, 40 to 50% of the people in China still live on the farm as basically subsistence, non-mechanized farmers, just making enough to eat. Their urbanization rate's no more than 60%. They got a long way to go. Per capita GDP, depending on how you measure it, maybe maximum 25% of ours. I like the number 20% more. They got a long way to go. And if they don't hit on some of these issues, continued reform, free market, rule of law, their progress is, and they're already suffering problems right now. Growth is slowing. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, rule of law, because it makes for predictability of business, the ability to plan ahead. When you don't know what the government's going to do or say at any given time, it makes it impossible to run a business. Makes it, well, put it this way, not impossible, but it makes it extremely difficult.
Well, not only predictability, Kerry, but one thing I would point out that, and you really get a sense for when you live in a place like China, predictability, yes, and a fair playing field, but also just to get a sense for what I would call the petty corruption. You know, high profile corruption cases get all the attention, but it's, you know, it's the local tax authority. It's the local sanitation guy. It's the local or the customs bureau clerk you deal with. It's the policeman. It's everybody having their hand out in society and making money as a gatekeeper. That's mm-hmm. what kills commerce. And China's doing some things to make that better. But the ultimately, the only way to do that is to make the government has less decisions in the economy. So it simply has less power, and the market's determining winners and losers. And China doesn't keep going down that path. It doesn't matter how many anti-corruption campaigns they've had, as they've had one in the last 5 years. It won't improve significantly.
Yeah, exactly. Could not agree with you more on that. Hey, so we got to take a look. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Hong Kong, where the demonstrations seem to have receded for a bit. They're more localized kind of flash demonstrations, if you will. And the Taiwanese elections, the effect that that's had on it.
Yeah, right. So a quick review for your listeners would be that in early December, Hong Kong held local elections. They're local elections. They're basically for like council seats where you don't have a great deal of power. But the fact is the pro-democracy movement within Hong Kong won by a landslide, which was a big deal. And it seemed to take the head off of the protest, the tension. There was kind of a 3 or 4 week intermission between protests, and it's taken the violence out of them. They have taken back to the streets, not as frequently. So I would not say in any way, shape, or form that that movement is dying down. But hopefully they'll avoid kind of the violent issues that I think gives China more of a reason to be unreasonable, if you will. And then one of the big side effects was in the Taiwanese election, the candidate who won a year ago, her political career was in jeopardy for a variety of reasons related to domestic, economic, and political issues. But once the Hong Kong trouble started last summer, and she's the more hardcore, independence-minded Taiwanese candidate, whereas the other candidate favors a closer relationship with China. Well, that side just took off and she won handily. It wasn't even close. So I think the protest movement in Hong Kong can claim maybe so far their greatest victory is reelecting an independence-minded candidate in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one interesting thing is there was a lot of, I guess there was expose, a lot of revelations about China interfering in the Taiwanese elections. And in Australia, there was a highly placed Chinese spy. He had been in Hong Kong and in Taiwan. Actually, they wanted to send him to Taiwan, and that was where he called it quits. And he exposed all of this manipulation and infiltration by mainland China. And I think the story didn't get much traction here in the U.S., but I think it really was a wake-up call to the Taiwanese, along with the demonstrations taking place in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the Taiwanese are tremendous beneficiaries of a close economic relationship with China. And if suddenly there were to be a wall between the two countries, I think you'd find the Taiwanese extremely disappointed. So a hard push towards independence, frankly, doesn't make sense. And there is room for a candidate that says, listen, we can maintain our independence operating independently while still engaging China. So I wouldn't say that that type of candidate that lost this time will lose forever. But the Hong Kong demonstrations heightened that sense of awareness among the Taiwanese electorate that, hey, this is serious. China is pushing on these issues harder than they ever have. An invasion of Taiwan isn't imminent, but this mentality that we've got to stand up for ourselves, I think, will remain fairly strong, although they're going to want to continue to engage. Now, it's interesting you mentioned that Australia example. Lots of stories in Australia. I mean, they've had heavy Chinese immigration there, which the Australian economy is more closely tied to China than ours is. But they're even more than we are. They're having reason to reevaluate the relationship with China. And this political interference issue is one that is, frankly, far stronger there than it is here.
Yeah, and I'm sure to some extent it's probably taken place here as well. But it was everybody's worst fear finally coming to be realized that, hey, they really are out to take us over and, manipulate our system and get stuff out of us. And I think maybe it's a wake up call for the world, too.
Well, if you look at China right now, I always say to my Chinese friends, it's not easy being a superpower. Just ask an American. We've learned the lessons over the years. So China is increasing its reach. It's got a bigger global footprint. You know, it's got its presence in the South China Sea, which is, you know, China thinks is good for it. But now it's got increased tensions and greater military spending from all of its neighbors, Japan, Thailand, the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam. There have been anti-China riots. So, you know, they put the squeeze a little bit on Hong Kong, not even much. You see how much Hong Kong pushes back. You see the influence that has on Taiwan. It turns out soft power is difficult to wield. We know that ourselves because going back even 40, 50, 60 years ago, every time we've extended a helping hand to, for example, Latin America, we don't get much in return.
No, we get a
thumb their nose at it.
It's hard
to have a positive impact. What's that?
We get it bitten off, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
No good deed.
So it's hard to have influence and build relationships with these countries. And I think, you know, there's a lot of concern right now what China is, you know, and the infrastructure projects, the One Belt, One Road initiative, what they're doing in Africa. I think in 5 years, we look back and say, wow, did they get their hand bitten on that one? I mean, because I'm not exactly sure. When I look at much of what they're doing, some of it, not everything, obviously, but some of it in terms of using money and investment, everything to build relationships, we've done that in the past. And it's way harder than you think it is.
Oh, yeah.
They love you when the money comes in. They hate you once the money dries up. What's the point?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you see them trying to help Africa and they're winding up with the same exact issues that we had with the corruption, the aid not getting to the right people who need it most. And you got to like kind of laugh and shake your head. It's like this stuff just doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't work.
Right.
So, well, I guess that's part of the education process for an emerging superpower. I appreciate Dan coming on, giving us the update on all these issues because they seem to have a lot of them disappeared from the paper, from the media. All they're caring about now is the coronavirus and that it's the death of man. And, you know, feeding the panic, but really there's a lot more going on there. Anyways, hey, place to find you is thechinalearningcurve.com.
As always, yes. Thanks. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah, all right. We'll have a link in the show notes for this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Make sure you sign up for our newsletter, Twitter feed at Gary Lutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Dan, thanks so much. It's great to hear from you.
Thanks, Gary. Great talking to you again, as always. Thanks.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.